And it's just afternoon. You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Mulawa'a, K284AL, Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we'll get comfy with Russian comfrey, marvel at seed anatomy and function, and get on track with livestock tractors. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and More, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and More features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556-6.
Honohola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Code guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. Honohola Stringed Instruments.com or 822-616 for building Island Code guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972.
Nutrients, mediums, all natural compost tea, light, aquaponic, and
complete restoration, repair, and reforestation.
Honohola Stringed Instruments.com
or 822-616 for building Island Code Garden.
It's raining underwriters.
Well, we're having some technical challenges here here at KKCR. The buttons and dials are giving us some very interesting results.
However, we'd like to thank Harvest Market, Natural Foods and Cafe, Anahola Stringed Instruments, Kauai Marine and Mower, and
Garden Island Hydro.
Yes, thank you, generous underwriters. We appreciate your supporting the show.
Indeed we do. And we are grateful right now to be with you in the garden on the farm on Kauai Community Radio. We are focusing in on seeds this month, and we're excited to have a look at seeds with you. We do have some great news that the Seed and Plant Exchange, we finally nailed down a date of March 22nd. It's a Sunday. It's going to be held at the Ninaho Community Park in Kilauea. That's the home of the Kauai Mini Golf, the great farmers market that happens there on Saturday and Wednesdays as well. Skate park.
Mondays.
Mondays, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
The Kilauea Pavilion is going to be built there this year. A very exciting place, and we're excited to bring the Seed and Plant Exchange to you on March 22nd. Put it on your calendars.
Yes, a great community event. And as we know, this community event here at KKCR takes place every day. Great programming, great programmers. And we'd like to let you know that every day can be a donation day here at the station. We're still working on our air conditioning fund. And we appreciate any and all help with that.
Indeed we do. So if you're interested in helping keep us on air and keep the air flowing, you can call the office at 826-777-4-7774, or you can go to kkcr.org to make a tax-deductible donation to our nonprofit. And as well, we want to let you know that there is a board of directors meeting coming up tonight in Kapa'a for the Ke Kahau Foundation, which is the organization that umbrellas KKCR, and we'll play you a brief PSA for that right now.
The Kikau Foundation, license holder for KKCR Kauai Community Radio, will hold its quarterly business meeting on Wednesday, January 21st at 6 p.m. at the All Saints Church in Kapaa. All interested parties are invited to attend. For more information, call Steve at 652-3706.
Okay.
Thank you, Dean. So we're going to jump into our celestial session as we do each and every week, looking for inspiration guidance to the heavens above and for our planting, harvesting, and other activities that we might do in the garden or farm. And today's moon phase is brought to us once again by the 2015 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, which is a Hanalei Watershed Hui publication. There are many other organizations contributing. The U.S. Naval Observatory gives us information on the rising and setting times of the moon. And if you're interested in a printed copy of the calendar, you could call Maka'ala at the Hanalei Watershed Hui office at 808-826-1985 to get your own if you are interested in that. Today's Hawaiian moon is Hoaka. Oh yes, what a beautiful sliver of a moon. Hoaka is the second moon in the Hawaiian moon month.
Yes, can I say, I was anxiously so wanted to see it rise today, but it rose about 1 hour after the sun,
right,
according to the calendar.
Yes.
And there's no seeing it. The sun obviously outshines anything that nearby, but right. I do realize that tonight,
yes,
it will be trailing behind the sunset.
Yes.
So there's a chance it'll, yes, be dangling up there next to Venus.
Yes, clouds allowing, cloud bank allowing,
yes,
for us to see that beautiful moon Hoaka, who rose over Kauai at 8:12 a.m. this morning. She'll reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 2:06 p.m., and she will set at 8:04 this evening. 3% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated tonight. The new moon was yesterday at 3:14 a.m., so we've got a fresh start on our moon cycle for our activities. Hoaka is a crescent or an arch, which can be seen in the shape of the moon. It also means brightness, shining, glittering, splendid, and it is a splendid moon. And the planting recommendations in general say that it is not recommended. However, according to the Native Planters in Old Hawaii book, some recommended planting sweet potatoes and taro the day after Hilo, which of course is the moon Hoaka, although they will be small when mature, as the new moon is small. So if we were thinking about seed, then if we were going to get many small taro plants, then that would be very good if we were looking to expand our the size of our huli collection. This would be a good day for planting our taro.
Oh, geez, you can tell where my mind's at. I thought, ooh, baby sweet potatoes. They sound delicious.
So thanks to this wonderful tome, The Native Planters in Old Hawaii, I think a lot of people turn to the information here for the moon calendar information. And if you could give me an opportunity once again to read the opening chapter about the moon phases. So beautiful the way this is written. Whether or not there is any foundation in this tropical land for the theory of influence of the moon on plant growth, the fact of the systematic and careful regimentation of planting in accordance with this theory evidences a high degree of discipline and logical thinking and behavior. Taking into account the fact that these were practices adhered to by a whole population intent upon maximum productivity for the sake of livelihood, a people who in other practical matters affecting physical growth of their plants showed amazing powers of discrimination and observation. It certainly seems to the writers that to regard this whole theory of relationship of moon phases and habits of growth as superstition is somewhat rash. Scientific experiments in inland states in America have seemed to contradict old-time theories of the influence of the moon. But this does not prove that the same is true in Hawaii, where marine conditions, tides, currents, and so forth, impinging so closely on the land, are admittedly influenced by the moon. Also, it must be remembered that there are power and qualities in moonlight in tropical islands, undeniably affecting animals and human beings, which are of quite a different order from those in temperate continental areas. I got chicken skin.
It makes me want to go take a moon bath tonight. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, we're in the ascending moon time, so the energies are moving upward in the plant to the stems and leaves and fruits. Today, Wednesday, the moon is considered unproductive, although it is in Capricorn. It's not a good day, so we can do other things like scrounge up materials for compost, for instance. Tomorrow, the moon will be in Aquarius, an air sign, making it a good time to work with our flowering plants. And once again, here we are, ascending moon, flower time, great time to do cuttings. I'm hoping that now with a little more sunshine at our backs and just 1 minute more as of yesterday, that cuttings will start doing a little bit better. Friday through Sunday, the moon will be in Pisces, a leaf sign, making it time to work, or a water sign rather, excuse me, making it a good time to work with our leafy plants. And Monday, Tuesday next, the moon will be in Aries, a fire sign, making it time to work with our fruiting plants. This is an excellent time for pruning and harvesting fruits that might last a little bit longer on the shelf than when harvested at a different time. And we have an extra copy of the North American Biodynamic Sowing and Planting Calendar that we would like to give away in a little while on the show, sometime around 12:15. We'll let you know. But stay tuned.
Is that, it's 12:15
It's 12:15 now. Okay.
Sometime around
12:30.
12:30 then.
We will be giving away one of those calendars to one of our callers. So stay tuned.
Yes, please. This is In the Garden on the Farm with Paul and Robin. We're here until 1 o'clock. Coming up in this hour, life is better with livestock tractors. But right now, we're going to focus in on some notable news affecting us here in the Hawaiian Islands and right here on Kauai. Research training program on Kauai will demonstrate the value of IMOs in bioremediation of soil toxins. Boy, that's a wordy title. I actually came up with that this morning.
Yes, it is, but bioremediation is important. So much of our soils have, from past poor agricultural practices, been contaminated with lots of different things.
They have been. Our agricultural soils in both areas that are used for commercial agriculture as well as a lot of people's backyards, which people, you don't have to go too far back in history to find many of the residential areas used to be production fields. And so there are a lot of these legacy chemicals. They can be taken up in a humble garden plot as much as they can in a big agricultural field.
And unfortunately, just a quick look at the Good Neighbor Program website on Hawaii.gov will let you know that those legacy chemicals are still being dumped on the soils of our island every single day in large amounts. And many of these chemicals are linked to health problems, not just of the soil and soil life, but human beings as well.
Birth defects and chronic health issues, cancer, you name it. We humans are poisoning ourselves, and so it is up to we humans to heal ourselves. And if we don't heal the soil, we never can truly be healthy because that's where our food comes from. So in a great effort to do that, Permaculture Kauai is leading the charge and partnering with the Hawaii Farmers Union United Kauai chapter, the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, and Regeneration's Botanical Garden are getting in on it as well, collaborating on a bioremediation project to address legacy agricultural toxins in our soils, including DDT, atrazine, glyphosate, many more. Thanks to our good buddy Ray Maki, who's put this program together. He teaches Korean natural farming courses from time to time. This will be the latest effort. Soil tests will be taken and sent to the Pacific agricultural laboratory where they'll be screened for more than 350 potential toxins. And then some trials will be done to see if the inoculation, or basically the adding, amending of indigenous microorganism blends via the Korean natural farming technique can actually digest or bioremediate the toxins. And so this will be a scientific research project. That it will also be a two-day workshop, and there will be a 30-minute video that will be developed. And Regenerations is going to participate alongside by doing soil testing, the soil testing portion of the program at our the site for our seed bank there at Waikoa. And basically we're gonna find out whether or not we can take the healing of our soils on Kauai into our own hands using totally natural, low-tech solutions that anybody can create on farm at a very reasonable cost. And it's a very exciting program. We've been talking about it for some years. Thanks so much to the County of Kauai, which is providing the vast majority of the funding for this project. And we can't wait to see what we find out from it. It's going to be really, really a good thing.
I'm looking forward to it, too. I'm rooting for the IMOs, for sure.
So stay tuned. The dates of these courses, when the workshop will be held, has not yet been scheduled. I think it's getting started, even the tests are getting started even this month, and it may be February. I think it's coming up pretty soon. As soon as we know, we'll share the information with you about when this bioremediation workshop is going to be held here on Kauai.
Ah, good news. Well, is it time to crack open the medicine chest?
I think we should.
Let's.
Yes, and this is a perfect companion for our show today. Given the fact that we are concerned with the health of humans, we're concerned with the health of livestock, and we're concerned with the health of the soil. And here is a plant that can provide health for all three. I'm going to jump into a little bit of the botanical and share some of the medicinal qualities for humans. And this is our friend, the comfrey plant, often called Russian comfrey. Symphytum is the genus, and there are various species, but the one that we most commonly encounter is Symphytum uplandicum, which is a hybrid between two different species and is commonly known as Russian comfrey. And there is actually a preferred strain called the Bocking 14 strain, and it was developed by Lawrence Hills, who developed many different strains. This particular strain is sterile, which means it only is propagated through vegetative means, which is good because it can spread if as a seeded plant. I haven't seen it happen myself, but apparently in certain places, even too much of a really good thing is too much. And so with the sterile strain, at least it's only going to spread where you spread it by propagating it. Medicinal uses are legendary for this plant, considered one of the warrior plants by our dearly departed Kumu Levon Ojai, one of the plants he held in the highest regard, used in Chinese traditional medicine for over two millennia, and proclaimed as the most useful medicinal plant in our entire garden by the good folks at Horizon Herbs. Mm. So definitely a super warrior plant. Known as bone set and knit bone, this medicinal herb can literally heal broken bones, both through compress or internal use. There are many fabulous healing properties. The plants do, however, contain varying amounts of hepatotoxic alkaloids that are toxic to the liver, hepatotoxics. And so the root, as I was advised, the root should never be used internally, only for a poultice. And the leaves, depending on the variety, have varying amounts of these alkaloids. And again, the Bocking 14 strain is known to have the least amount of alkaloids in it. So in order to be sure that you actually have that strain, I suppose we would have to go back to a supplier that actually knew that they were carrying that strain. In general, the plants that we have here are probably that, but there's really no clear way to know unless you were a botanical specialist. Very many uses for this plant, very beneficial to the digestive system. I was taught to blend the leaf in a blender with water and then strain it. Since the leaves have an irritating bristly hair quality to them, that if you just did a straight poultice of the leaf, you can get an irritation. I've actually experienced that before. It is contraindicated during pregnancy and nursing. And as with any of the medicinal plants that we talk about on the show, we are not recommending specifically that people use these medicines, only to let people know that people do use them and that they can be highly beneficial, but be your own guide and definitely always do the research to make sure that any potential toxicities or contraindications that may be specific to your situation are taken into account. So there are some of the qualities from a human medicinal standpoint, but Robin is going to share some of the qualities for the garden.
That's right. It's not only medicine for us, but it's medicine for our gardens. Its deep roots make it what's called a dynamic accumulator. So it mines nutrients from deep in the subsoil, and it makes them available in the leaf of the plant, which when we then harvest the leaf, we can activate our compost with it, as comfrey leaves are high in nitrogen. Make a nice layer in there if you're doing a layer cake type compost. You can also put them in a bucket of water and rot them down a little bit and make a high nitrogen comfrey tea. I also know, I experienced it myself, that Sun at One Song's been having really great luck just layering them in a trash can and putting a weight on top, and this beautiful leachate comes out. There's a little tap in the bottom of the drum.
Beautiful being a subjective term.
Beautiful being a subjective term, but, you know, it smells like manure. It just smells so good. And mulching or side dressing our plantings with leaves from the comfrey plant, it's also a really great companion plant. Now, comfreys, when they're happy, can get pretty big, so probably wouldn't companion plant it with something that's fairly delicate, because, indeed, the comfrey will overtake a delicate plant. But also the leaves are high in potassium. There's more than two times the amount of potassium in comfrey leaves than in barnyard manure.
Wow.
So a powerhouse for our plants. This is a great one to be having growing along our edges, our fence lines, and harvesting nice, healthy, fresh green leaves for use in our gardens.
And this is a plant that you can really harvest the heck out of, and meaning like cutting off all the leaves and off it will sprout again. Back to the Bocking 14 strain, it's said that it contains even more potassium. If the standard true comfrey has an NPK rating of somewhere around 2.55, the Bocking 14 strain has 7% potassium over the 5% potassium for the regular strains. So it really seems like, oh, it also has a deeper taproot, apparently, which would make it a better dynamic accumulator. So interesting to see how that plant could be distinguished or acquired. We were growing the true comfrey because it goes to flower, which is so beautiful, and yet... I see many photos on the internet of of the Russian comfrey or the hybrid also going to flower. So botanically speaking, I'm a bit mixed up about how to distinguish these apart.
Oh, it would make a flower, but not a seed, not a viable seed from that flower.
Potentially.
Well, I was interested to see that it's related to borage, and when you look at the flowers, they're very, very similar. Well, just an excellent plant all around. I also want folks to know that I've done some experimenting with propagating it, and in the beginning I always felt like I needed a piece of root with a bud growing out of it. but I didn't have a lot of those, and I just had lots of, like, long, rubbery roots. So I simply cut them into one-inch pieces and put them in a little pot of soil. It took a while, maybe 3 weeks, but it sure as anything shot up a whole new bud off of the side of just a smooth root. I had no indication that it could do that, and I was really impressed.
Yep. Rob Cruz taught me that trick as well, and you can just take the 72-cell trays and put these little pencil-shaped roots in there, and sure enough, it does take a while, I agree, and yet, boom, we had a whole new crop of plants just like that. Suggestion on propagation from Wikipedia was to scalp the plant about 3 inches below the soil level and then separate that crown. Of course, you can harvest the leaves as well.
Oh, and then from the existing roots, whole new plant will shoot up.
Exactly.
Incredible.
So just after doing the research, just makes me want to double down and grow more comfrey and nutrify the garden.
Well, after checking out that tea that Sun was making, it sure got me propagating comfrey, too. Mm-hmm. That's gold, liquid gold.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think it's about time to give away that calendar. So to the next caller at 826-7771, you'll get yourself a North American Biodynamic Planting and Sowing Calendar for 2015.
It's got the pull-out calendar for the wall.
Yes.
It's got lots of articles on biodynamic techniques.
Yes, and there's the whole back section this time is about pest ash. So it's about how you can overcome common garden pests by burning them and reapplying the ash of them back into your system, which I find utterly fascinating personally.
And done with a respect for all life. That's something I'd like to learn from the biodynamic system, because I know that it has a respect for all life, and yet practitioners are encouraged to harvest these insects and burn them.
Sure.
So holding that reverence of knowing that even while we respect life, that sometimes we have to take life to survive and to do our function as a gardener or farmer, is something I'm always wanting to keep in balance.
That's right. Well, it's a push and pull, right? There's life and death are but one cycle, round and around, and certainly the compost pile has taught me that better than anything.
Truly. This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. It sure seems as if we have we have our caller.
Yes.
Together.
I think we do.
What do you say, Mac? Done deal.
Great. Okay. We congratulations.
First name? Yeah,
Pauling
from where?
Paul.
Yeah, from Lawai.
Excellent. Well, let's move into our feature for today.
Yes, indeed. We're going to talk about the amazing anatomy and physiology of the seed, the humble seed that gives us life, and this amazing structure that seems to be inert, that seems to be lifeless, and yet is alive, is breathing, is ready to produce a young plantlet. This seed that is the representation of the marriage of the pollen parent and the seed parent's genetic material mixed into one, and with a structure that is amazingly resilient but also can be quite delicate, and that we need to be careful to understand the qualities and the natures of seed if we want to have success with them.
Sure. It's the real gold. You know, we can work the soil all we want, but if there's not a good seed to put in there.
So, Robin, I'm wondering if you can run us through some of the basic parts of the seed, and we can talk about how they influence the directions in which we take as planters in these considerations.
Absolutely. Well, firstly, seeds can be defined as a mature, fertilized ovule. Doesn't that just sound sexy? And inside the seed is an embryo. An embryo. I mean, the similarities to how we talk about humans are abound here in the seed talk. So
yes, and when these plants and these humans are just embryos, they look so similar too.
Yeah.
And we share DNA.
Yeah, it's and embryos are, they're curled up inside the seeds. Inside the embryo are the cotyledons, which you've heard us talk about many times before. There's either one or two,
and they're often confused for leaves. When the plant germinates, you see that what are the first leaves, but they're not really leaves. They are the cotyledons. They're green, so they're photosynthesizing, and they seem to perform that function, but they really contain the starchy energy that allows the plant to do its first growth without having to require on outside nutrients that it would access through photosynthesis.
That's right. And, so much more than a leaf going on there. And then there's the radical. I love that name. That's the embryonic root. And this is one of my favorite things about seed sprouting is noticing how it's the little radical that comes out first. You know, it's gotta be foraging before it can open up.
It has to geolocating,
I believe
it's called.
Yes.
So basically the radical is all about making sure that the seed is oriented properly to the sun so that the plant can be growing in the right direction. So it's kind of like getting its feet underneath it before the rest of it emerges.
That's right. And in between those two is called the hypocotyl, and that's a stem-like embryonic access that's below the cotyledons. So that's basically in between the root and the cotyledons.
Yeah. And then we have the seed coat, the ever-important seed coat, which is perhaps as we are interfacing with the seed, there's all this magic stuff that's inside the seed, and it's, of course, our effort to not disturb that. But what we connect with is actually the seed coat, which protects what's inside, and it comes in many different shapes, sizes, and qualities.
Indeed it does. And underneath the seed coat, also there's the embryo, but there's the endosperm. And the endosperm is basically the food storage. That's the pantry from which the young seedling will eat from until it has enough roots and true leaves to start photosynthesizing.
And the cotyledons are a kind of endosperm, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So some plants have cotyledons. All seed-bearing plants have cotyledons, either one or two.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So then we've got the seed coat, and sometimes there are multiple coats. Sometimes they're very thin, and you can have a seed that germinates right away, and other times you have very thick seed coats. These are all based on adaptations for the environment in which they are growing, and the seeds are very smart about being able to hold off their germination if necessary to wait for the right environmental conditions, whereas other seeds don't have that process, and they require immediate germination. And so in order to have success with seeds, we need to understand the anatomy of the seed in question so that we can respond appropriately. We may choose to plant the seed right away with no treatment at all, or in an sort of the opposite end, we may actually remove a seed coat or at least scarify the seed coat to allow water to imbibe. And now we're getting into the physiology of the action of germination and imbibition of water into the seed is what kickstarts the germination process. And that's something that sometimes we have to do mechanically if we want quick germination.
That's right. But before that, we want to recognize these different dispersal mechanisms, the way that the parent plant decides to let go of its seed or create its seed for that matter, and that results in what kind of seed coat it has and how it moves around. And so we all know the example of the maple tree with the little helicopters. You remember?
Called a samsara.
A samsara. Beautiful. Yeah. That's spinning its way down at the whims of the wind to go here or there. It makes me also think of the feathery parachute type seed dispersal of, say, a dandelion, or lettuces are similar like this too.
It's a pappus.
Ah, pappus. The wish. We used to call them wishes. Right? And other ones have barbs, like hitchhikers, they disperse themselves very creatively on our socks or pant legs.
Yes, and we've talked about the aerols of seeds as well, which is sometimes a fleshy exterior which attracts animals that want to eat on them.
That's
and,
right.
Yes, many members of the yew family. I'm trying to think of our aerol friends.
Well, the aerols were the longan,
yes,
and the lychee.
Yes, the trees. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. The aki.
Yes, yes. And apples, too, all those kinds of things. They encourage animals to come and munch on them and potentially even digest them and then plant them with some fertilizer, if you catch my drift.
So seeds require not only water but oxygen. And so seeds require, in some cases, good plenty access to good gas exchange, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So in most cases here in our terrestrial environment, that is supplied for, but is an important consideration to the physiology of a seed and its germination ability. So when the rubber hits the road and we're thinking about how we want to treat our seeds, we want to think about these different issues. The application of hormones can also have an important effect on the germination or to either promote or inhibit the germination of seeds as well. And while many of the common vegetable seeds that we work with, because they have been grown for thousands of years, actually germinate quite easily, when we start looking at wild seeds, there are many mechanisms by which the seeds avoid germination unless they have been scarified either by abrasion or perhaps by the digestive juices of the inside of a dispersal animal.
Or even fire in some cases, right?
That's right. Fire can be an important consideration, where the seeds don't want to wake up unless there's been a big fire, because they're thinking, well, if there's been a fire, there's probably a whole lot of open habitat that has been burned down. And so these fire-adapted species proliferate in these circumstances. Some of these fire-adapted species actually spread fire, which is one of the difficult challenges we have here in the Hawaiian Islands. I'm thinking specifically of the fountain grass, which is a fire-adapted species, and it's sort of one of these positive feedback loops where the more fountain grass you have, the more wildfires you have, and then that spurs on the germination of the fountain grass seed, and then you get more conditions that are more conducive to fires. And a lot of our most imperiled ecosystems here in Hawaii, as well as throughout the Hawaiian Islands, are dryland, are those dry forests. And so these challenges are in place when the dispersal mechanisms are detrimental.
Of invasive species, sure, because our beloved native plants generally, if I'm correct in thinking, don't have that need for fire. And so it doesn't really help them out at all. In fact, it takes them out so that more invasives can move in.
Exactly. Fire, of course, not completely unknown in the pre-human contact Hawaii. For anybody who's done enough hiking around in the backwoods, we will encounter trees that have been hit by lightning, and small fires, areas can burn from these situations. But pretty unusual circumstance with the humidity and the moist environments here. Fire not a really super large factor in the evolution of habitats and ecosystems. So I just want to direct people toward this most beautiful book. This is a beautiful volume called Seeds, Time Capsules of Life. Rob Kessler and Wolfgang Stuppi are the authors, and this produced in collaboration with the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. This is a table coffee book of photographs of seed, many different kinds of seeds from around the world, with an electron microscope, and then they're colored photographs. I think they're colored, artificially colored, to bring out the different aspects of seed from around the world, all the various adaptations. There's some great, pretty scientifically dense information about haploids and triploids and all kinds of other head-scratching words in here. But what a magnificent book. If you are interested in seeds and you want to experience the beauty and the wonder of seeds, I couldn't recommend higher a book to fascinate you with this world. So have a look, people, if you choose. Maybe it's in the library. So right now we're going to turn to our final phase of our show today. Secrets of the Soil Builder is going to focus in on a great soil building technique, and this is the livestock tractor. And a lot of people have heard of chicken tractors. That's just one example of a livestock tractor. And we're going to get into this with our guest on the telephone joining us right now, John Parziali. John is a permaculture homestead farmer in Molawa'a who incorporates livestock in his ecological agriculture system. He's been running chicken tractors at his farm for quite a few years and knows the ins and outs as well as anybody I know. So really grateful that you're with us, John. Thanks for joining us.
Aloha.
How's it, brother?
How you guys doing?
Really good.
Great to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, my pleasure.
How does your tractor plow?
Well, you know, it's been going pretty good. Actually, it's in a little bit of, one of my first chicken tractors is about 10 years old now, so it's starting to show its age. Because, you know, they're subject to the weather and that type of thing. So they need to be rebuilt here and there. But, if the people are going to try to construct them, there's lots of stuff on the internet you can check out. You want to build it as sturdy as possible, but also as light as possible.
The preferred material there then?
I just use dimensional lumber, and then for roofing, I really like the poly panels, real lightweight corrugated.
Oh, like the Lexan.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. You can get them at most, at Home Depot and stuff like that. But that's, because if you use metal roofing, that adds quite a bit of weight.
Sure. So let's
say. And that's speaking more about chicken tractors. I mean, it's interesting that, when I think of an animal tractor or a chicken tractor, you think of a self-contained movable unit. However, I've also heard people refer to, chicken or pig tractors, which are just, in essence, a movable sort of shelter, and then with an attached range, with electric fencing or portable fencing of some kind.
So essentially we're talking about rotational grazing, but what kind of sets it apart from traditional grazing is that you don't necessarily have to have one huge area that is fenced off. You can rotate them, you could stick it on your truck and rotate them at your neighbor's place and then bring it back again, kind of thing.
Sure, exactly.
And let me ask you, John, what's the perfect size? I'm sure that if you've made a few of them over the years, I mean, how many chickens really realistically can you have in one unit happily?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a few different sizes. The one that I like the best is 8 by 10, 8 feet by 10 feet, and I use that actually for laying birds. Oftentimes, chicken tractors are used, for meat variety birds too. But I use mine with my layers, and I just mount a little nesting box inside. But 8 by 10, it's so you have 80 square feet. And, I think a density of, you're giving each bird probably about 4 or 5 square feet per bird. So you could probably have 16, 17 birds inside that tractor with, in their stove. They seem to do just fine.
And
if you compare that to the stocking density of, some of the commercial chicken breeder, chicken factory type things, where each bird has less than 1 square foot.
Oh, wow.
you know, you know, 4 or 5 square feet, plus the fact that you're giving them, you're moving them every day, so you're giving them fresh flooring every day. Mm. It's a pretty good system.
And is that size something that you can move by yourself, or is that a two-person job?
Yeah, and even sort of, yeah, exactly. If it's built correctly, it shouldn't be, anybody could move it. You know, if it was built, you know, I usually use, you know, some of those solid wheelbarrow tires, you know, and then that way when you pick up one end, you've got a couple of wheels in the back there helping you out. Mm.
Now, what about protection from roving dogs, or even pigs can take out chickens, yeah?
Yeah, I haven't had any problem. I have had a dog attack my chicken tractor one time, and he got in there. I mean, I have chicken wire on the outside, and I recommend, you know, you can staple that really well. And, you know, as an added support, you could probably even trim that out with something to make it more, you know, a little stronger, have like a batten edge on it or something to prevent that. But it's definitely a concern. Mm-hmm. But that would be a concern if you had a chicken coop, too, or any right. any type of, you know, enclosure for a chicken that was relying on chicken wire.
Right. So let's back up for a second. We're talking about chicken tractors and livestock tractors in general. Let's cover the basics of why is this a better system than having a larger... I mean, in a way, it seems like, wow, well, if I fence off a big area for my chickens, won't they be happier? And then I don't have to get out there every day and do something to it.
Right.
So what are the benefits?
I think with any animal system from... You know, from a baby chick to a Holstein cow, I think that one of the things that you want to incorporate in your system is movement, is like that rotational component of letting an area like recover
right.
from that animal's pasturing. And then simply, with chicken tractors, I mean, you don't have to just wheel these around your pasture. You can use that in the garden as well. In fact, one of the things I wanted to mention that was one of the more successful things that I did when I was doing more commercial vegetable production was integrate the chicken tractor into the field. And at the time, I was using a lot of cover crops. I was using buckwheat and then either like a cesbania or a cowpea as a nitrogen fixing cover crop. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I don't remember exactly when this was, but whatever cover crops I was getting from off island were just jumped in price so significantly that it made me sort of try to reconsider my cover crop plan. So I kind of withheld on the expensive, legume cover crop, like the nitrogen fixing cover crop, and instead I just grew buckwheat. And then I had the chicken tractor move through the field of buckwheat, and I waited until the buckwheat had seeded. So not only were they getting the greens of the buckwheat, the chickens, but they were also getting a high protein seed. Mm. And that was a really great system. Again, I'm not doing so much commercial veggie production anymore, where I have like a large field of buckwheat anymore. But that was such a great. You know, I found that, like, the nitrogen that got left behind, and then it was turned into the soil. And the only thing that was left of the buckwheat was just, like, a withered stem. I mean, they ate everything, seed, awesome. Flower, leaves. And,
So John, that's making me wonder about the fact, because of the fact that animal feed, and especially animal feed that's organic and that doesn't contain GMOs, is so expensive that... Mm-hmm. It seems like that's a real barrier for people who want to grow eggs and want them to be GMO-free eggs. Is that part of a strategy then to get seed and put them and actually run them like you did with the buckwheat? Does that part of their grazing or that part of their diet contribute to the egg-laying portion of their diet, or is that not high protein enough, or what's the factor there?
Oh, I think that you could definitely, I mean, you know, you might, you know, there might be a slight decrease in production, but again, if you compare it to the, all the embodied energy of, you know, shipping in chicken feed from the Midwest, and then you also have to add in the fact that you're not also not spending money on, you know, pelletized chicken manure for your field either. So there's, you know, there's that factor you have to factor in as well.
Yes.
But in terms of nutrition, I think that, you know, I mean, certainly, you know, you might want to be looking at some high calcium additions for the egg layers. I think I was primarily running meat birds at that time with the buckwheat, so I don't have any real, you know, hard data on, you know, what the egg, you know, egg layers, or even just using some layer feed as almost a nutritional supplement, you know, so they're not maybe deriving the majority of their energy or protein from that feed, but they're getting, you know, a good calcium supplement from it, you know, that might be a good way to look at it.
Yeah. Well, hey, John, for people who, you know, have fairly big gardens, what's the turnaround time? Like, how long after the chicken tractor has moved on does one want to wait until that manure that's been left behind has enough time to sort of break down before you can put a crop in? I'm curious.
Yeah. You know, someone could probably call in and give the exact, I'm pretty sure that I remember like a 90-day window, like in terms of like organic certification, if you're using, you know, if you're using raw chicken manure, that's not something that you want to be necessarily growing a 30-day arugula crop on top of harvesting, right?
Sure.
But I think that all comes down to the quality of your soil. If you're dealing with soil that's sort of new to the garden, you know, or new to gardening, then you have to be probably a lot more careful. If you've got soil that you've been, you know, organically farming for years and you're doing compost additions and biological spraying too, then that manure is going to disappear really quickly. So I think that, you know, there's probably some guidelines, you know, especially with the organic certification that, you know, that would give you a very safe sort of estimate at a return time. But I think that, just from my own experience with my garden at the time that had years of farming and compost tea spraying and compost additions and cover cropping and just a lot of really good practices, you know, 10 or 12 days after, you know, tilling that stuff in, like I would, you know, you couldn't smell any kind of, you know, ammonia smell. I mean, it was, you know, I felt pretty good about growing food right into it, you know.
Well, that's the common sense approach. And then we have this Food Safety Modernization Act coming up that's going to probably surpass the organic certification requirements for these issues.
I think that's something that really is, you know, actually the beginnings of the speaking about that was one of the reasons that I, you know, that moving away from commercial production was, in my mind, it was what I wanted to kind of focus on, you know, outside of that, because I think that I think it's something we should be guarding against. I think it should be fought against. I think it should be protested. I think it should be, you know, without a call to action, I think, you know, we should be wary of the effect that it would have on sustainable farming and small-scale food production, especially where we live.
I agree completely. And luckily, the Hawaii Farmers Union is taking steps in the ways that they can on a national, state, and even island level to let your voice in that way be heard, John. You know, it's certainly something that there's a very legitimate concern that it could push the small producers out of business because of the stringent requirements and just the unrealistic dynamics of looking at each ecological farming practices like the chicken tractor and saying it's not sanitary enough, we can't allow this to happen. So we do need to let our voices be heard.
Well, meanwhile, on the government websites, it's being disclosed how many pounds of the most toxic chemicals anybody's ever heard of are being sprayed on the land, and that's okay.
Pretty wild. So in addition to chicken tractors, lately I've been hearing of the rabbit tractor. Have you seen one of these?
I think it's any animal. I think one of the things, and I wanted to mention this too, is that, you know, from a permaculture perspective, whenever you're dealing with an animal, it's a great idea to just, you know, make a short little punch list of the functions or just the behaviors of the animal that you're going to tractor. You know, like chickens like to scratch. Chickens like to roost. They like to, you know, take dust baths. They like to, you know, they like to be in the shade in the hot sun. So you have to look at the wide range of behaviors of that animal and make sure that whatever tractor system or whatever, you know, movable housing that you're making is gonna make a happy animal, and then that's gonna just make your job so much easier over time that you it's gonna set you up for success. And then even with pigs, I mean, I had some pigs that had like an electric fence range, and it was amazing what they did. I mean, when you talk about tractoring, I mean, you know, chickens are really good at scratching the, you know, the first half inch of soil, but I mean, these pigs like rototilled some rows between my orchard for me in such an amazing way that I took pictures of it. It was awesome.
So it's not, I have the fear from hiking in the backwoods, and we see these places where the feral pigs have basically created these wallows, and it seems like what they're doing is compacting the soil and creating these non-draining areas, but you're probably
in a really moist, you know, flooded area that you, exactly. But I just had a little run set up probably about 10 feet wide between my orchard rows. And it was anything but compacted. It was, in other words, it was rooted up and, like I said, tilled. It was really cool. It looked like you ran through it with a rototiller.
Well, yeah. Not only that, I think there's a bit of a movement on the mainland right now. I've seen a lot of farms are starting to get back into the old horse-drawn plow. So there's yet another take on the livestock tractor, in my opinion, literally putting the horsepower out there to work, fuel-free way, and I kind of like that idea, too.
Indeed.
Well, John, thank you so much for taking some time to share your experience with us, and I know I feel inspired to reconsider setting up one of these systems myself.
Yes, probably one of the best animals to start with, you know, chickens are really suited to the tropical environment, and they're just a great, you know, protein source, you know, from, you know, with their eggs or their meat, and very, very sustainable food production option.
Yeah, small kind. Well, John, we always appreciate having your practical experience.